Don't you hate when this happens? You gather for the holidays. Christmas carols are in the air. Trees are lit with fairy lights. You're ready to exchange gifts. And then, wouldn't you know it, someone gets killed and you have to figure out who did it. Yes, the holidays sure can be murder. Sounds like the perfect time for episode 35 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your Don't Quit Your Gay Job host, Howard Kasner. For my listeners, please like, follow, or comment. Today, I am happy to welcome back a previous guest, film enthusiast and podcaster and lover of Christmas movies, Jay Kluwet, who has agreed to join me to talk about a couple of holiday films. Jay has chosen Shane Black's directorial debut, the dark comedy Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, while I have chosen the classic detective film based on the Dashiell Hammett novel, The Thin Man, both about murder during Christmas time. To begin, Jay, why don't you tell our audience something about yourself?
Hello, thank you for having me back on the show, Howard. Something about myself. Well, since I was last on, I've started another podcast. I've abandoned the podcast I used to host, the Lambcast. I've left that to previous guest you had on here, Richard Kirkham, and he's doing a wonderful job continuing hosting that. And I am now hosting Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, a podcast dedicated to Rennie Harlin's 1999 shark-infested masterpiece, Deep Blue Sea, which myself and my co-host Mark Hoffmeyer, we analyze one DVD chapter a week of Deep Blue Sea, which is a 97-minute film with 33 chapters, which is frankly an insane number of chapters, but we're having a fun time doing it.
And where can we find this?
Anywhere that podcasts can be found, basically. Just search for Deep Blue Sea, the podcast. Or if you go on my site, lifeversusfilm.com, there's a link to it from there. Or Mark's site, my co-host Mark Hoffmeyer. Movies, Films, and Flicks is his site, and there'll be a link to it from there. It helps if you're a fan of Deep Blue Sea, I think. But it's not essential, because we don't talk about the chapter at hand for the entire episode. So we often find tangents and paths to run our way down.
Great. Well, with that, let's get to your selection, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is an American film released in 2005. It was written and directed by Shane Black. It stars Robert Downey Jr., Val Kilmer, Michelle Monaghan, Corbin Burnson, Dash Mihok, Larry Miller, Rockman Dunbar, Shannon Sossaman, Angela Linval, and Lawrence Fishburne. The basic premise revolves around New Yorker Harry Lockhart, a petty thief who, along with his partner, is trying to steal a toy for his son at Christmas time. After setting off the alarm, his partner is shot by a bystander, while Harry flees and somehow ends up in a movie audition. He actually ends up getting offered a screen test and is flown to L.A., where he runs into an unrequited love from high school while getting involved in a murder mystery with Gay Perry, a gay private detective who is an advisor on films. Why did you choose this film?
Because I really like it would be the main reason. You asked me to pick a Christmas film. I sent you a list of Christmas films. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was actually added to the list at the last minute. I thought, hey, we could cover that. It's a film that I've seen a bunch of times. It had been, I think, 7 years since I last watched it there. Actually, the last time I watched this film was for my first ever podcast. The first Lambcast I was a guest on was covering Kiss Kiss Bang Bang as a movie of the month. So it kind of holds a place in my heart for that. It was first recommended to me by a colleague in 2007, where he just said, hey, you like films. This is the most entertaining film I've ever seen. You should watch it. Just entirely based on that, I went out at lunchtime. I bought the DVD. And that evening, I sat down, I watched it, and I was thoroughly entertained. And I still am to this day. This is at least the fourth, maybe fifth time I've seen the film. And every time I watch it, I'm delighted.
So it sounds like you definitely think it holds up.
I think for the most part it does. It's kind of more negative towards gay people in some of the language. I think a lot of the characters are more homophobic than I remembered. So in that sense, I don't think it holds up very well. And it does tend to employ Michelle Monaghan running around in a skimpy Santa baby costume for no real reason other than, hey, let's watch Michelle Monaghan running around in a skimpy Santa baby costume. But outside of that, those same faults can be applied to far more films for far greater offences. So aside from that, yeah, I think the language-wise and story-wise and style-wise, it holds up a great deal.
I first saw it when it came out. And like you, I was just thoroughly, thoroughly entertained by it. At the time, I think a lot of us who went to saw it, besides being thoroughly entertained, we had a sort of interesting reaction to it. So we were all fans of Robert Downey Jr. He was this incredible screen presence who pretty much stole every movie he was in when he was only playing supporting characters, especially in movies like Less Than Zero. He was the only real reason to watch the movie. He was obviously extremely talented, but his career had really hit the skids because he was hopelessly addicted to drugs.
Yes.
And before he did this film, he had even gone to prison. And there was the incident of him waking up in the bathtub of some stranger's house, not knowing how he had gotten there. So we were in many ways very concerned, even though we don't know him. What is the matter to us? We're just moviegoers. But we thought of him as such a strong talent that we were afraid we were going to lose a really major actor. And then he comes along and he gets hired to do this movie, and he's wonderful. It's a perfect role for him. He just takes over, and it's this big comeback, and he's never looked back.
Yeah, this was basically his audition for Iron Man. Even he recruited Shane Black to direct Iron Man 3. But before Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I think I'd only ever seen Downey Jr. in Weird Science and Shortcuts. And so he wasn't an actor who was really on my radar. So this is essentially my introduction to him as an actor, and I was blown away. I was then thrilled, because this was sort of a year before Iron Man came out. Like, what's this guy doing next? Iron Man? Awesome! I was on board for anything he did in the future. To date, he's an actor I will watch in almost anything. I have not seen Doolittle, I have not seen The Judge, but I'll watch him in anything else. Things like Zodiac, he's awesome at like Iron Man films. Like Tropic Thunder, I know there's some controversy around that character, but I think he's fantastic doing what he's doing.
Well, he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And before this, before Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, he got an Oscar nomination for playing Charlie Chaplin.
Yes, I still haven't seen that.
He's very good in it. The movie is just an okay biopic, but he is really very, very good. Also, I'm a big film noir, especially 1940s, 50s fan. I love crime movies like that. I love private detective movies. I love murder mysteries.
Me too. I really enjoy them as well. I like to try and guess where they're going, and I'm rarely right.
I thought Shane Black did quite an incredible job, even though it takes place in modern day at the time when it was shot, of channeling these films from the 1940s and 50s, even though he was more influenced by crime films, he said, from I think the 70s and 80s.
And it's a very intricate script. It's a crime drama that references crime novels and crime films.
Right.
Within its script, not even just stylistically or aesthetically. They're part of the script. One of the suspects, it turns out to be the star of a TV series based on a series of crime books. It's very convoluted trying to map out the entirety of the plot, which is all part of the fun, isn't it? Trying to keep your head in front of the mystery isn't the appeal of these films. I think it's watching other characters work it out, for me at least, find that more entertaining than trying to work it out myself.
Well, that is true. If you have a good private detective movie, if you have a good crime drama, it's not the actual solution of the crime that's usually the most interesting aspect of the story. It's characters and the way everything plays out, and often the repartee.
Yeah, there's a moment in here where Downey Jr., he narrates the film, and he says, like, so, listeners, have you worked it out yet? And I'm like, no, show me. I'm not going to work it out, you are.
I had seen it before, and I couldn't quite remember who had done it and what all the various twists and turns were.
That's the great thing about mysteries. The solution is usually just the last couple of minutes of the film.
Right.
And so you spend so much more time on the journey and such a little bit on the destination that the destination is often forgotten. So the next time around, you're watching and think, I love it when this bit happens and this bit happens. Wait, who did it in the end? Oh, that guy. That's why they're so entertaining, I think. You can watch it again and not quite remember what happened at the end.
I enjoyed it so much that, one, I guess I was hoping there would be sequels, but I never quite understood why there hasn't been a television series based on
it. Oh, that'd be amazing.
And in fact, back at the time when it came out, I read screenplays and did coverage for a production company that primarily focused on gay subject matter. They were looking to do a television series. And I said, you really should look into doing a television series based on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I would think it would be a huge hit.
Maybe if Downey Jr. hadn't become so successful so immediately after this film, they could have tied him to a TV show.
Perhaps. Or you would actually just get another actor. I doubt Robert Downey Jr. would do it. Val Kilmer might, because we all know what happened to Val Kilmer's career.
This is the last good film he was in, I think.
Sort of like A Star Is Born. Their paths are crisscrossing. And of course, probably what didn't also help is that it made its money back, but was not a financial success.
Yes, that's probably the more important aspect.
What are some of your favorite scenes?
The entire film.
I know. I have the same problem coming up with my favorite scenes. I get it. I understand.
I really enjoy the Russian roulette sequence.
Yes.
It's 8%. Who taught you math? It's fun watching Robert Downey Jr. just become older and more irate with everything that happens. And that's peak irateness, I think. Just getting hit and kicked around for no real reason, for other people pissing people off. And he's the one who gets punished for it. And then things don't go well when he tries to fight back. literally the whole film. I can't think of a bad moment, a negative moment in the film. I had a short run feature on my site called Guaranteed Happiness. I was watching like depressing films often because I cover the 1,001 movies before you must see before you die list, which is a list of films that aren't fun to watch for the most part. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, not on that list.
Right.
So I would now and then pick a film that would just make me happy. And this is one of the first ones that I chose, was Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, just because I watch it and it cheers me up. It's almost like a perfect film.
I think for me, certainly the highlight has to be the opening title sequence.
Oh yeah, it's very kind of soul bass.
Right, it's done by Danny Yont. And it is, it's very retro. And it's very smart. It's a lot of fun. And I also love the audition scene.
Yes, that is very well done.
Where suddenly he just rises to the occasion and starts improvising.
All the interactions between Harry and Perry are just the most entertaining bits. And when Harry discovers the corpse in his shower and he urinates on it, and then he has the phone conversation and he says, I pee on the corpse. I've got a question. And Perry's like, no. I get the first question. Why? Why did you pee on it?
Well, they do have this great repartee and this great relationship, which I think we will see in many ways mirrored in The Thin Man.
Yes.
Because they just have this great chemistry and their repartee is just bouncing off of each other. So I agree with you. Any scene with Gay Perry is certainly,
just like the nickname.
Is certainly the highlight of the film. The film also looks very good, I think. It's very well directed by Shane Black. Are you a fan of Shane Black?
I am. I would say he has made three very good films, and then The Predator, which is not a good film. He did a TV movie called Edge. I've not seen that. I think it's telling that the first film he made that's not set at Christmas is terrible. So Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Iron Man 3, and The Nice Guys are all set in or around Christmas. The Predator, set at Halloween. Never again. Stick to Christmas films. But yeah, I love Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I love Iron Man 3. I love The Nice Guys. Of the three, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is my favorite.
And Lethal Weapon?
He didn't direct those. He wrote
No, but he wrote
but that's it. Set at Christmas as well, yeah. And he did The Long Kiss Goodnight, I believe, as well. Kiss Goodnight, Last Boy Scout.
You mean the end of Gina Davis's career as a great actress in film?
Yeah. There's a connection to Deep Blue Sea, both directed by Rennie Harlin. I'm sure he's not to blame. That's not Gina Davis's fault. Long Kiss Goodnight is a great film.
I think I have to disagree with you. I'm watching it and think, oh my God, this is what happens when you let your husband choose what films you're going to be in.
I enjoy it. And Samuel Jackson says it's his favorite role.
I just find something very interesting about the movie that in some ways has changed a little bit for me in seeing it another time. And the movie in many ways is very post-postmodern. Not only is it postmodern, it calls attention to the fact that it is postmodern. Not just talking to the audience, but the way they talk to the audience and the way they give information to the audience. Telling the audience, yes, I know I'm in a movie. And I know I'm in a movie that is about a murder mystery.
You're in a movie that's talking about movies.
Movie character talking about being in a movie.
You're being narrated to by a narrator who knows he's not a good narrator and is learning how to be a narrator whilst he narrates.
Right. And knows he's a fictional character.
Indeed. But also, he's narrating and he's taking the mick out of writers whilst he's narrating. Who the hell is he? Just a writer.
That's right. And I think somehow it feels a little dated in that way. At the same time, even though it's dated, that somehow made it even a bit more fun for me in a strange way.
Well, yeah, it kind of makes sense if it's riffing on noir, which noir is a bit dated at this point as well. There are noir films that are fantastic, don't get me wrong, but the concept, if a straight-up noir film was released this week, it would feel out of place. I'd love it to happen. That'd be great. So it's riffing on noir, which is outdated. The film being outdated itself kind of makes sense. We haven't really talked about Michelle Monaghan all that much. I think she's really good here as well.
I think she's very good, yes. But something you said about the negativity toward gay people and then having McConaughey running around a skimpy outfit does bring up an issue I also had. I'm not so bothered by the negativity toward gay people because the movie, first of all, it's very honest. That is the way people would talk at the time. So even though that does take me aback and yes, does bother me because I am gay. At the same time, as long as it's honest, realistic, I think we're supposed to think. These aren't very nice things to say. So I don't think Shane Black is being homophobic. I think he's creating homophobic people.
Yeah, it's the main characters who say the homophobic things. It's Harry. He's on a learning journey. So by the end of the film, he and Perry are friends and he's kind of helping him out now. The two henchmen, Dash Mihok and Rockman Dunbar, they say negative comments. And Larry Miller's character, Dabney, he's just like a big studio exec. They're right. Scum of the earth. The more evil characters, should we say, are the ones that are more homophobic. I'm a big fan of the Two Old Queens podcast where they're trying to find the gayest film ever made. And so just listening to them talk about that, talk about how gay people are perceived in films. It's a fantastic podcast. I recommend it to everyone. I'm picking up on it a bit more how some of the films that I really enjoy maybe could have handled some things better. better. And so I'm just trying to take more notice of that as I move on through cinema.
Well, if you're really interested in that, there's a book called The Celluloid Closet by Vita Russo, which was one of the first books that talks about how gays were portrayed in movies. And there's also a documentary based on the book. And yes, if you see that, then you start looking at movies much differently than you did before. But when it comes to Michelle Monaghan, and one of the things I think that did bother me about the movie this time was its attitude toward women. Robert Downey Jr. has this big speech about the only women that come into LA are damaged.
Yep.
That bothered me. One, it's simply not true. It's just the only women he runs into in the movie, they're damaged. But of course, he only runs into them because Shane Black expressly chooses the kind of woman that he's going to run into.
And it implies that all the men are sane.
Right.
Any criticism he has of the women, he should probably apply to the men who are there for the exact same reason.
Right. At the same time, Michelle Monaghan is very much an aggressive alpha female type character. She jumps in to help try and solve the mystery and is fearless. Even though she has somewhat of a damaged past, she's much more together. She has her head on her shoulders. She's much more of a Nora Charles from The Thin Man in this. So there is both of these going. But this time around, when Robert Downey Jr. got to his, all these women are damaged, I felt, no, that's Shane Black's view.
Yeah, it's just unfortunate that the primary female character in the film does have the damage in her past. She has the history of abuse in her family. Shane Black's proving his own point, which he's not allowed to do.
As I said, it is very postmodern. One of the fun things about the movie, besides constantly calling attention to it and talking to the audience, the movie is divided into different chapters. All the titles of the chapters are from novels and short stories written by Raymond Chandler. Trouble Is My Business, The Lady in the Lake, The Little Sister, The Simple Art of Murder, and then the epilogue, Farewell, My Love.
I did not know that.
Yes, the only thing he seemed to leave out was The Big Sleep. So he knows his film noir. He also has a very particular screenwriting style that he's known for. Sometimes it drives people like me and other people who read screenplays for contests and production companies a little up the wall. It's not so much the way he writes it. It's that everybody who reads it then thinks that they can write exactly the same way Shane Black can write a screenplay. One of the things, for example, that he's known for is when they get to the party at the house, which in real life was Shane Black's house, the narrative goes, he reaches this mansion, the kind of multi-million-dollar mansion that I would buy when I sell this script.
Yeah.
He does that throughout his screenplay, and it's a lot of fun, and it's very funny. That's not really a problem. It's that everybody thinks they can be Shane Black. So you get these screenplays in which everybody's trying to do the same thing. And we're just kind of shaking her head and saying, well, fine, but you're not really Shane Black.
So we don't need you to be Shane Black. We have Shane Black. You be you.
I tell people when you read screenplays, don't copy what you like. Decide what you don't like about the screenplay, and then don't do that. And that's the way to develop your own style.
I think that's good advice. Speaking of properties that people own, I couldn't believe that Harmony, who was a self-confessed failed actress, had a beachfront Venice Beach apartment. That seems like it would be far more expensive than she could afford.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever any explanation for it.
No, you can almost dive off of her balcony into the sea.
Right. That's one of the things you see a lot in these movies.
Yeah, it's a standard film complaint, isn't it? How do they afford the apartment in France? There you go.
So we talked about Robert Downey Jr. We're both big fans of Downey Jr. We're both fans of Shane Black. I think it's a shame that this did not do well, and neither did The Nice Guys.
Yeah, I really like The Nice Guys.
I'm not sure what was going on. What I read is the main reason why this movie did not do better than it did was it didn't open wide.
I didn't even hear about this film until it was recommended to me 2 years later. It passed me by completely. I'm not even sure I got a UK release. I haven't looked into that. Probably
in LA, it was a big deal, but they never gave it a wide release. It made most of its money overseas.
Maybe it's because it's a grown-up film, but also it doesn't really take itself too seriously, so it's not an out-and-out drama. You can't take your kids to see it, but people who think they're adults wouldn't go and see it as well because it's too fun, but it's not a full comedy. It's kind of dancing through different genres, perhaps.
For whatever reason, it just only made its money back. And then The Nice Guys also didn't do very well either. And it's too bad because I wanted to see more movies like The Nice Guys. I wanted a sequel as well. And if either of them had been a hit, maybe there would have been a sequel.
Yeah, I'm surprised The Nice Guys didn't do better. Because if you look at who stars in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, as we've discussed, it's Robert Downey Jr. coming out of prison, basically. You've got Val Kilmer, whose career was very much on the descent. And Michelle Monaghan, who was an up-and-comer but wasn't a household name. Was Mission Impossible 3 before or after this? Mission Impossible 3. 3 was a year after. Whereas The Nice Guys, you got Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, two huge A-listers. And at that point, Shane Black is a bigger name. He's coming off Iron Man 3 and doing The Nice Guys. I feel like that should have done far better.
Maybe there is something about the detective film that's simply going out of style when it comes to movies. I find it hard to remember off the top of my head, when it comes to movies, any private detective film that is actually done all that well. And like many genres, the crime film, especially the murder mystery film, has gone to TV. We see limited series.
Yes. Did Knives Out do well? I don't really follow box office.
Well, I think Knives Out was a huge hit.
That's a murder mystery.
That's just connected with the audience. It probably was also less expensive to make.
It's kind of sad that when I try and think of a successful detective story, the one that comes to mind is Detective Pikachu, which I don't think should be the prime example.
But you're right, Knives Out did do very well. And I think there's supposed to be a sequel.
Yes. So, blew my mind with the intro when you read the cast list. I had no idea that Lawrence Fishburne voiced the bear in the commercial in this film.
Well, he's uncredited, so yes. I had no idea either until I was doing my research. With that, here's some more information about the movie. As I said, it was not a big success. It cost $15 million to make and made $15.8
million. Hey, profit.
Yeah, profit. Earning back its production cost. It actually played for a long time in L.A. It did last for about 4 months in the movie theaters, but I guess it is kind of an L.A. picture.
It is a very L.A. film, isn't it? Yeah.
Lawrence Fishburne is the bear in the Gennaro Spear commercial. He is uncredited. The crime plot basically draws from Brett Halliday's Bodies Are Where You Find Them. Halliday is the creator of the detective Mike Shay.
I'm not familiar with Mike Shay.
He was hugely popular in his time. There's a series of movies with Lloyd Nolan as Mike Shay that are often a lot of fun. They're often very witty and very fast-paced. But he was one of the most popular, and I think probably still is, detectives in novels, for people who are into that. And we were speaking about Val Kilmer's character, Gay Perry. And the reason why he is gay is simply because Shane Black wanted to do something different. Had never seen a gay private detective. So he thought, okay, I'll make him gay. You do find gay private detectives in novels, as far as I know. At least this is the first openly gay private detective.
Yes, Poirot hasn't come out yet, as far as I'm aware.
Yes. With that, let's get to my selection, and that is The Thin Man. For some information about the film, The Thin Man is an American film released in 1934. It was directed by W.S. Van Dyke and written by married couple Albert Hackett and Frances Goodrich, based upon the novel of the same name by class detective novelist Dashiell Hammett. It stars William Powell, Myrna Loy, Marina Sullivan, Nat Pendleton, Mina Gumbel, Porter Hall, Henry Wadsworth, William Henry, Harold Huber, Cesar Romero, Natalie Moorhead, Edward Brophy, Edward Ellis, and Skippy.
Can't forget Skippy.
Can't forget Skippy, yes. The story revolves around married couple Nick and Nora Charles. Nick is a former private detective who married the wealthy Nora and retired from the business until one Christmas in New York when he is approached by the daughter of a former client of Nick's, a scientist who has disappeared. Nick reluctantly gets dragged back into solving a murder along with his wife, who finds it all much more exciting than he does. What do you think of the pairing of the two films?
I think it's excellent. I had never seen The Thin Man before. Thank you for suggesting this, because, spoiler alert, I really enjoyed this film. But I think it's an excellent pairing, because you have two Christmas-adjacent detective films. A lot of people, I think, would disagree that they are Christmas films. They are films set at Christmas, which, as far as I'm concerned, makes them a Christmas film.
I agree with that.
I hate the whole, is Die Hard a Christmas film debate. It is. Sod it. It's set at Christmas, therefore it's a Christmas film. Just go with it. No one's saying you can't watch it in June. Watch it whenever you want. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, The Thin Man. Christmas isn't part of the plot. They just take place around then. There are Christmas parties in both of them. Fine. The fact that they are also detective stories with a really intricate plot that's hard to follow, and there's a dog in both of them, it's a perfect pairing. Applaud you, Howard. Well done.
I must say, I also do love the scene in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
The dog eats the finger.
Where the dog eats the dog.
It is the most believable part of the entire film. If I left part of my severed finger on the counter, one of my dogs would have that in minutes.
When did you first see the film?
Last weekend. It was a difficult film to track down, but I managed to find it. I've discovered I am a fan of William Powell. I've seen him in a few films. I really enjoyed him and Myrna Loy, just their pairing, their back and forth. Their repartee was just delightful. And again, just like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, it's not really about the mystery. If you're watching this for the mystery, you're probably going to be disappointed. It's watching the detectives try and work it out. Fun game to play. Try and drink along with this film.
As the series does go along, William Powell does start drinking less and less. But for those first few films, it's almost impossible to find him without a drink.
It's incredible. And he's often had several drinks before. Like, he's six martinis in for one scene.
In the opening scene, yeah. And
she sits down and requests enough to catch up.
Just lay up six alongside here. Sounds like you very much enjoyed the film.
I did. Would you recommend the franchise as a whole, or is this peak with The Thin Man? And
I actually like the second one better than the first one. I like After the Thin Man. I think it's a little better directed. It has Jimmy Stewart in it.
Ooh.
And sometimes when you see old films, you see a joke that you think is actually rather recent, but you realize that sometimes the joke goes back much further than you thought. And then After the Thin Man, there's this joke where William Powell shows up at Nora's family's huge mansion because she's very rich. And they have this old doddering butler who's half bent over and shuffles along. And he tells William Powell, walk this way. And William Powell says, well, all right. He bends over and shuffles along in exactly the same way the butler does.
That feels like a Mel Brooks joke from Young Frankenstein or something.
Exactly. And I'm sure it dates back even farther than After the Thin Man. I'm sure it's an old vaudeville joke. I like them all. They're not all as good as the first two, but I just enjoy them. When The Thin Man came out, this was something new. This was something that the audience had never seen before. It was about a man and wife who loved each other.
But also, they liked each other, too.
Yes. There's that stupid scene where William Powell pokes his finger into her stomach. She looks down and he lifts his finger up to her nose. The film is just filled with them.
But they have great chemistry. It's a very believable couple.
And a lot of it was improvised as well, because they got together. Before this, if you had a movie about a couple, they were falling in love, about to be married. Or if they were married, they were in crisis. They were going to be divorced, or they were falling apart, someone was having an affair. And that's all you got. And then you have The Thin Man come along. Now, of course, in order to do this, it's not really about them loving each other. It's a murder mystery. Because if you only have a movie about two people in love, you have absolutely no conflict.
That's so true. You say that, but he does punch her unconscious in one scene.
Yes. But basically, there's not a lot of conflict because they're happily married and they really like each other. The conflict comes about because of this murder mystery where he's seen it all, done it all, and he's not really that interested in getting back involved in that sort of world. But she's lived a sheltered life, and she finds him and his friends very interesting and very exciting. At the time, this was very new. This is something no one had ever seen before and was one of the reasons why it was so successful. But Pauline Kael said that modern audiences probably would have a hard time getting that, finding it as new as or exciting. But I was working at a video store when they brought out all six Thin Man series at a time, and we couldn't keep it in. The people who were renting it were couples, people who were dating, people who were married. They wanted to watch all of them. So I do think they got it. I think they did understand what was so new and what was so refreshing, because even today, you really don't have movies about happily married couples or happily dating couples, unless it's a mystery or unless it's a sci-fi or something else.
Now I know that it's a good film. Try and circle back around and try and get my wife to watch it.
I think it's a fun thing for couples to watch. I first saw it, I can't say. I have absolutely no idea. Probably in college when they were showing films at night and on the weekends. I was a big fan of Dashiell Hammett. When I was young, I used to read comic books a lot. Up until somewhere around eighth grade, I started saying, why am I reading comic books? So I got back into reading books and novels. One of the ways I started was I would read books that had been made into movies, because I was also getting interested in movies. And one of the first ones I read around that time was The Maltese Falcon. Since I liked The Maltese Falcon so much, I had to read all of Dashiell Hammett, so then I read The Thin Man. So I'd read the book. Eventually, I had to watch the movie, and it is very enjoyable. It is really a lot of fun. What are some of your favorite scenes?
I really enjoyed the scene where Nick punches Nora out. It was so unexpected. I just give the listeners a little context if they haven't seen The Thin Man. He's trying to save her from being shot. He's going to rush a guy with a gun, and so he punches her out so she's not in the firing line. It makes no sense logically.
No, it doesn't.
Just try and imagine that being released in a film today. It's incredible. But yeah, that had me crying with laughter when that happened. And I always enjoy a good wrap-up scene when they get all of the suspects together. I love how much the police have humoured Nick to go round and not only round up all of these people and bring them to their apartment for this meal, but also to then act as waiters at the meal and force drinks into the hands of the guests and force them into their chairs. It's a very funny scene in what is already a very funny film. Just watching how much fun William Powell is having as Nick in stringing everyone along, including Nora. He's just something. He's not going to tell anyone what it is. He's going to take a real protracted way of getting there. It's standard Poirot business, but it's just fun watching him delight in doing that.
And that's the way it is in every one of them. Eventually, they get all of the people together in one room.
Everyone who has spoken in the film so far, right. Whether they be a suspect or not, whether they're just in one scene throwing a saucepan at somebody.
Yes, those are wonderful scenes. I should talk about that final scene because Myrna Loy says that was actually the most difficult scene to shoot. W.S. Van Dyke, who directed it, had a nickname, and it was One Take Woody. He felt that if a scene worked, then he would not shoot more scenes because he thought that the actors would lose their freshness.
Okay.
But for this scene, it was a rather long scene. William Powell, as Nick Charles, had a lot of dialogue because this is all exposition. He did have some trouble remembering the lines, so they had to keep reshooting things. One of the problems is they were serving oysters.
Oh, no.
Yes. And they had to keep bringing
Why? Why would they do that?
I don't think they thought it through because they would have to keep bringing out these oysters under these hot lights. And of course, the oysters got boiled. And she said that nobody wanted to eat an oyster for a long time after filming that scene. Oh. But that is a wonderful scene. Some of my favorite scenes, there's this little moment at the beginning where Edward Ellis, who plays Clyde Wynett, the one who disappears.
Thin Man of the title.
Right. Leaves. He's going down the sidewalk and his shadow becomes very, very thin. And I thought that was very, very clever. And that's the last you see of him. Nora's entrance is one of the greatest entrances in film history.
With the dog.
Yeah, she's being pulled in the dog and she falls flat on her face, which she did herself. That was not a stuntman. And it also has that wonderful line. William Powell is telling the waiter, this is my dog. Oh, and this is my wife. And she's, you might have at least mentioned me first on the billing. Yes. And the Christmas morning scene where William Powell is shooting the BB gun at the Christmas tree and shooting the balloons.
At the balloons, yeah.
And misses, and it hits the window, the door to the balcony, which apparently wasn't in the original script, but when they were setting up the Christmas tree, William Powell had a BB gun. He started shooting at the ornament, so they put it into the film. That also has some wonderful lines with Nora in the mink coat. He says, why don't you take that off? You must be hot. And she says, yes, it's stifling, but it's so beautiful. And he says, oh, did I buy that for you too? And she says, yes. And he says, oh, I'm spoiling you.
I liked his line of he didn't have time to take the case because he's trying to stop her from spending all that money he married her for.
Right. And that's a running joke throughout the whole thing where he says, oh, I retired to manage my wife's estate. And he never does. He has someone else that does that. I mean, they're just wonderful lines. It's actually a marvelous screenplay. And one of the reasons is the screenwriters, again, were Albert Hackett and Frances Goodrich. They were purposely chosen because they were married. They had been married for 3 years. They were told to focus on this witty banter and this relationship.
And I think that shows from the banter that they have. Both characters feel equally rounded. Nick is in the film more because he's the one handling the case, which is a shame. Yeah. I'd like Nora to be in it just as much. They make a fuss of sending her to the wrong place a couple of times so she's elsewhere.
Right.
But they both feel like very real characters.
There's often been talk that this was, to a certain degree, based on Dashiell Hammett and Lillian Hellman, the playwright's relationship, because they were in a relationship at the time that he wrote the book. People say that Nora Charles is based on Lillian Hellman, and then Dashiell Hammett would say, yes, but all the other female characters are based on her as well, including the wife of the scientist. They kind of had this kind of relationship in real life as well. They had a very tempestuous relationship. But you do mention William Powell and Myrna Loy. They are fantastic in this movie. They have this great relationship. They had made at least one movie before that was Manhattan Melodrama. They went on to make 14 movies together in a 13-year period. They were that successful. They had that kind of chemistry. Not only that, they actually play a married couple where William Powell is a private detective and she's the wife who helps him solve a mystery, and it's not Nick and Nora Charles. This was a slight change of pace for both of them. The studio was reluctant to cast both of them. William Powell was a bit more of a gentleman in his films before this. So this playing of this more down-to-earth private detective was not what he usually played. And believe it or not, Myrna Loy before this played what was called exotic roles.
Okay.
Temptresses and sirens. She even did yellow face.
I can see her doing the exotic roles because she is a very attractive woman.
She has these eyes, kind of mesmerizing eyes.
I recently watched Best Years of Our Lives, another fantastic one. She's great. She's playing a similar role in that one to The Thin Man, where she's the wife of one of the military guys and they have a great relationship, a lot of banter between them. She's very good at that kind of role. I need to see her in more things.
That is the role in many ways she began to play, the very sophisticated wife. You'd probably like Mr. Blanding's Builds His Dream House, where she's married to Cary Grant, Bachelor in the Bobby Sox Award. So yeah, she's a marvelous, marvelous actress. She never got an Oscar nomination, which was unfortunate, but she did finally receive an honorary Oscar.
It was unfortunate. I think her Thin Man role deserved one.
It probably should be noted that, of course, though everybody thinks that Nick Charles is the Thin Man, he is not. Thin Man is actually the one who gets murdered, he's the clue in many ways to the crime. But like Frankenstein, as the movies went along, they just started referring to him as the Thin Man.
Well, I guess it doesn't help that each of the franchise films has Thin Man in the title, and I'm guessing exactly. They're not all about the same guy.
No, they're not. They do things like After the Thin Man, which is the second one, which takes place upon their returning to San Francisco from New York. So it goes from a murder mystery at Christmas to a murder mystery at New Year's Eve.
Oh, okay.
And then they do another Thin Man. And then by that point, you're okay, whatever.
It needs to be like the Adventures of Nick and Nora, the Thin Man.
Even for the television series, it was also called The Thin Man.
They had their brand.
That's right. When you have a brand, what can you do? Everybody thinks that sequels, series, and brands didn't exist before the year 2000, but no, this was one of the most successful brands of the time. It should also be known in 1934 was the end of the pre-code era. So this movie barely gets in before the Hays Code comes into effect. The whole movie is a bit salacious as it is, but there are especially two lines that I doubt very seriously would ever have passed the Hays Code the next year. And that's when the police are searching the apartment. They're going through the chest of drawers where Nora's clothes are. And Nora Charles says, "What's that man doing in my drawers?" And near the very end, the line where Nick asks his wife, "Where were you in 1902? She says, "I was but a gleam in my father's eye."
Yeah, I think that'll be fine today, but back in the Hays Code period.
And actually, the Thin Man does become more and more, you might even say, family friendly for the time. There's less drinking. They have a child at one point. There's even one Thin Man goes home where he doesn't drink at all.
Yeah, these films are becoming less and less appealing, Howard.
But I think they're all fun. I'm not going to argue that they're all at the same level as The Thin Man or After the Thin Man.
Okay.
With that, here's some more information about the film. It cost $226,408 to make, and it made $1,423,000 worldwide. It was one of the most successful movies in the U.S. at the time. It took 12 days to shoot. I think some people think it took a little more, but it basically took less than 2 weeks. He would often use improvisation. In the scene where Nick Charles is preparing the drinks in the opening, and he's telling them, "You do a martini to a waltz step," that Van Dyke had told Nick, "We're just going to walk through it. Go ahead and improvise." And then when William Powell was done, Van Dyke said, "Cut." He had been shooting the whole time.
I really liked that bit as well. That's great.
Yeah, he would tend to do that. Marina Sullivan, who played the disappearing scientist's daughter, is probably most famous for playing Jane in Tarzan, and also perhaps today even more famous for being Mia Farrow's mother, and can be seen in Hannah and Her Sisters.
Okay.
Cesar Romero, who is the gigolo in the movie, is perhaps most recognizable as playing the Joker in the Adam West TV Batman.
I didn't recognize him because he didn't have a mustache. It was painted.
Right. And Skippy, who played Asta, was one of the most successful dog performers at the time. He was first seen with William Powell earlier in the Kennel murder case, where William Powell also played a private detective, Philo Vance. But he was also subsequently cast in two of the greatest screwball comedies ever, The Awful Truth and Bringing Up Baby.
Ah.
It got 4 Oscar nominations for picture.
I thought you said Skippy did.
No, the movie got 4 Oscar nominations for Best Picture, Best Actor. William Powell received a nomination, Best Director, and Best Adapted Screenplay.
All well-deserved, I think.
The Thin Man was the name given to a 3rd unused atomic bomb at the end of World War II. Hammett's The Maltese Falcon gave the other 2 bombs their names, Fat Man and
Little Boy. Yeah.
In closing out, is there anything else you might want to add about Kisses Bang Bang or The Thin Man or both films together?
I highly recommend them both. If anyone listening hasn't caught either of these, then I would suggest good luck finding The Thin Man. But if you succeed, then watch it. It's very entertaining, as is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
In the US, it's very easy to find.
Okay, well, congratulations, people in America.
Yes. With that, let's start closing out. And I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
I wanted to find some other Christmas-adjacent mystery films, and I found 2. One, L.A. Confidential,
right,
which is a film that I greatly enjoyed in my youth. I haven't seen it for a few years. years because it stars somebody I don't like to watch anymore. But you do get to watch them die. It's a very
will be mentioned, but
people can work it out, I'm sure. It's a great film. It's a film that I think is a lot better than the book. I never really liked the book of Very Confidential, but it's another one where I don't fully understand what's happening, but it's fun watching the people work it out and getting into the 1950s era of it all. And the other one, bear with me, is Die Hard 2. Die Hard 2 is a Christmas adjacent film. Everyone knows Die Hard. Great film. But I feel like Die Hard 2 gets slept on a little bit. And it's not as good as Die Hard. I'm not going to come up here and say Die Hard 2 is as good as Die Hard. It's not. But it's still a really good film. There is a mystery element to it. There's a twist towards the end. They're trying to work who's keeping these planes hostage. What are they doing? How are they crashing them? What's going on? We did a Lambcast episode on it. The supporting cast of Die Hard 2, everyone is not a nice person. Everyone's an arsehole, basically. And we're trying to work out what the collective term for an arsehole is. We came up with a sphincter. So the cast of Die Hard 2 is a sphincter of arseholes.
It would be a sphincter.
Okay, a sphincter of arseholes. There we go. William Sadler, John Amos, Dennis Franz, William Atherton reprises his role as Thornburg from Die Hard. So many people who are just great fun watching be horrible to our hero. It's directed by Rennie Harlin, so I have some skin in the game a little bit. The first Christmas special movie of the month we ever did on the Lambcast.
As for me, I have two. It's Murder Mystery. It's the 2019 Netflix Jennifer Aniston Adam Sandler comedy about a long married man and wife. The man's a police officer. The wife is the owner of a hair salon. When the husband forgets his anniversary, he improvises a trip to Europe, where the two of them meet a very wealthy family and find themselves involved in a murder mystery. And the reason why this works so much, I'm not about to say it's a good film, just that it was an immensely fun film. One of the reasons why is this is basically a working class thin man type mystery. The second one is A Night to Remember. No, not the Titanic film.
Oh, damn it, I knew one.
This is a 1942 mystery comedy, which, again, I'm not going to claim it's a good movie, but it is, I think, a fun movie. For some reason, I always enjoy watching it. Stars Loretta Young. And in it, a woman marries a mystery author, but she hopes to get him to write a more literary type of novel by moving him into the basement flat of a Greenwich Village apartment building, just to give him atmosphere to draw from. And of course, they find a dead body in their backyard.
Of course.
Don't you hate when that happens?
Oh.
What is next? What should we be looking for?
My site is Life vs. Film, lifevsfilm.com. Now I have retired from the Lambcast. I am trying to get more into my own writing again, covering the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list and a few other lists. So I have upcoming reviews, hopefully, for The Thin Man and The Best Years of Our Lives, amongst other things. We have, as mentioned beforehand, the weekly Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, where we talk about Deep Blue Sea one chapter at a time. At the time of recording, we've still got about 10 chapters left to go. We are not going to finish once the film does. We will carry on with, we have some other topics to discuss afterwards, tangentially related to the Deep Blue Sea and otherwise. But we have a fun time over there. There are two sequels to Deep Blue Sea. I'm no longer host of Lambcast, but I still shepherd the Lamb, the large association of movie blogs, of which Pop Art is a member, and Howard's other site, Ranting and Raving, is a member. Here we are, the largest online collection of movie blogs. You can find us at largeassmovieblogs.com. If you have a movie blog or a podcast and you want to find some other like-minded folks and just hang out online, then come find us. Come join us. We have podcasts and movies of the month and blogathons and everything else.
Fantastic. As for me, I'll go through my usual litany. I'm a screenwriter and script consultant, so I have a Howard Kasner Facebook consultation page. My blog is called Rantings and Ravings, and it covers issues concerning screenwriting and film. I published two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are horror, sci-fi, fantasy short stories. I published the second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, and I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find those photos on Instagram. The previous podcast was with movie-it actor, director, writer, producer, stuntman, and podcaster Darren Minnell, where we discussed Big Trouble in Little China and That Man from Rio, both about characters who see their fiancés abducted right before their eyes. The next podcast will be with film enthusiast and podcaster Kevin Smith, where we will talk Captain America Winter Soldier and another William Powell, Myrna Loy film, Manhattan Melodrama. Both films about two childhood friends who end up on opposite sides of the law as adults. In addition, I also will be heading the Wonder Woman Lambcast that will be coming up, I believe, on the 27th of December.
Yeah, looking forward to listening to it.
With that, I just want to say once more, thank you very much for coming back on my show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Howard. Thank you for having me. Thank you.